evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Tuesday, May 7th, 2024. The closure of Karuma Bridge in Uganda sends fear among Ugandan traders in Juba.
I cannot guarantee that in 2 days I would arrive here. If I move well, I could reach in 3 days. But if the car gets spoiled on the way, I would take 5 days under repair.
And seven religious leaders from Western Equatorial State are asking President Salva Kiir to declare a state of emergency in Tombora following ethnic violence in the area. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Seven religious leaders have written to President Salva Kiir to declare a state of emergency in Western Equatorial State following sustained ethnic violence in Tombora County. The Bishop of Yambio Tombora Diocese, Eduardo Hiboro Kosala, says all religious leaders and institutions should be respected by men and women in uniforms across the country. This program made several calls to Bishop Kosala to comment on the letter, but he did not pick our call. Zimbabwe's parliament has started nationwide consultation after the cabinet in February agreed to abolish death penalty to conform with international standards. Columbus Mavunga has this story from a public hearing in Bindura, Zimbabwe.
Bindura, Zimbabwe, a crime-riddled mining town about 100 kilometers from the capital Harare and the site of a recent public hearing on the death penalty. Zimbabwe's parliament hopes citizens will support the bill abolishing the death penalty for crimes such as aggravated murder and treason. Energy Mutodi heads the parliament's justice committee, which is leading the hearings.
So like you've said here, the people have spoken and are coming up with different views. Some are for the idea that the death penalty must be removed. Some are saying it must remain in the OSED as a deterrent might.
Those against the death penalty, like Tinei Mashone, say the punishment is too harsh and archaic. He says if you look at the constitution, it protects women from the death sentence, but he and others are pushing for equality. He says that is the basis of constitutionalism and democracy, so there is a bias there. He supports the new bill so that people can be corrected. Zimbabwe cannot solve violence with violence, he says. Amnesty International says it hopes Zimbabweans support the proposed law to end death sentence. Tinashe Mujuru is a campaigner at Amnesty International Zimbabwe.
Once it's done, and if someone is wrongly accused, then we cannot then take that life back. Two, we are saying this law is something that is a colonial relic that came with the white colonialists, and they were using the death penalty to oppress the black majority. So we are saying, why are we still inheriting something that was being used against us as the black majority?
Some participants at the hearing said they are seeing people who killed their relatives walking scot-free. Some Zimbabweans called for imposing the death sentence on rapists and those who commit violent crimes like robbery. One of them is Nomvuyo Nedi.
Inini, I disagree. Nekuti.
She says she agrees with abolishing the death penalty because some people are pardoned after serving 5 years and released. She says right now she sees the person who killed her brother walking freely. What should she do? If there's no hangman, you can hire her, she says. The last execution in Zimbabwe took place in 2005, and death penalty opponent President Emmerson Mnangagwa last month commuted the death row sentences for some prisoners to that of life imprisonment. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Bindura, Zimbabwe.
From Zimbabwe, we move back to South Sudan, where an economist says the temporary closure of Karuma Bridge, a lifeline for South Sudanese, will push food prices higher in Juba and other towns, depending on food imports from East Africa. For VOA News, Dennis Longonyi reports from Juba.
Mawanda John Williams has been selling pineapples in South Sudan for 12 years now. Williams says he buys pineapples in central Uganda, which he sells in Gumbo Market. He says closing the Karuma Bridge for rehabilitation will present an obstacle to his business.
If we bring that vehicle right now full of pineapples, we can't even get profit of one egg. But still, that profit is what we are going to add on the other money for the fuel of the 50 liters which we must save. And right now, it's as if it's a coincidence, whereby even when you go back to Uganda, it's raining seriously.
Ahmad Ansoboga, a Ugandan national who sells watermelons in Gumbo Market, says he worries about the future of his business with the bridge closure. He says alternative routes for traveling to Juba could be expensive.
I cannot guarantee that in 2 days I would arrive here. If I move well, I could reach in 3 days. But if the car gets spoiled on the way, I would take 5 days under repair. A watermelon, whenever it is on the car, it heats up because of the carpet. So the faster it arrives, it's what sells it. If it's brought in time, it is still fresh. But if it takes 3 days on the road, then it will get spoiled.
Lubega Charles, a Ugandan national who sells tomatoes in Gumbo Market, says traders have already started feeling the effect of the Karuma Bridge closure. He says the government of South Sudan should work on the Juba-Nimule Highway so that traders can import goods quickly.
We want to call the government of South Sudan and Uganda to, first of all, to help the problem of the load. Our vehicle to move very well, even our things. Even the problem of dollar. They don't know how the government of South Sudan, they can help us in the problem of dollar. Don't you know? But it is also affect.
Akol Madok, head of economics department at the University of Juba, is calling on both governments of Uganda and South Sudan to work together to speed up repairs to the Karuma Bridge.
There will be delay in imports of goods from Uganda, from Kenya, all the way to South Sudan. And that means it's even going to double the transport costs for the goods being transported to South Sudan. That means if transport costs is doubled, then they will also have to double the prices. Because of this long route and the delay and all this, it will lead to shortage of goods in the market in South Sudan.
According to Uganda National Roads Authority, UNRA, Karuma Bridge will be closed to all lorries, trailers and large buses starting May 6, 2024 until early August. Mini buses carrying up to 28 passengers will be allowed to use the bridge. Motorists from Kampala heading to South Sudan will use Luwero, Kafu, Masindi and Para to connect to Pakwach or Gulu via Oluyo. Several media houses in Uganda have reported an increase in the fares for people traveling to northern Uganda. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
From Juba, we move to South Africa, where hundreds of political parties and independent candidates have registered for South Africa's elections in May 29. Most have no chance of winning a seat in parliament, but some political analysts say the record number indicates a healthier democracy, even as Africa's most developed economy faces multiple crises. Dylan Taylor reports.
115 political parties and 220 independent candidates are contesting a poll some analysts forecast will be the most competitive since South Africa's historic first multiracial election in 1994. That election ended apartheid and saw Nelson Mandela's African National Congress, the ANC, surge to power. Now, however, surveys show growing numbers of South Africans blame the ANC for corruption, violent crime, high unemployment and poverty, and long water and electricity outages. Most surveys indicate the ANC will get about 45% of the vote, which would mean losing the absolute power it's held for three decades. It still could hold on to the government by forming a coalition with smaller parties. The opinion polls show the next biggest party, the Democratic Alliance, registering around 22% of the vote, and the Economic Freedom Fighters taking 11%. One of the many tiny parties promising to improve South Africa is the Allied Movement for Change. Durban businessman Manzoor Sheikh Imam leads the Allied Movement.
We created the problem 30 years ago when we took a liberation movement who had no skills and experience in governance and put them in the deep end and expect them to run a country as large as South Africa. Given the inequalities of the past, we actually received a bankrupt state.
Another small party hoping for a seat in parliament is Sizwe Uma Nation, the Sun Party. It's led by businessman Rashid Gutta.
This country is well endowed with mineral resources and raw materials. We have the skills in this country, but they're aging because the factories have closed. So the people that are left now, the skilled people, are between the age of 60 to 70 years old. So we need to come with an aggressive plan to do on-the-job training and transfer the skills to the younger people. We have to start incentivizing people to start opening factories. We must put on taxes for these type of raw materials to discourage people from exporting the raw and incentivize them to export the finished product.
Surveys show that of the smaller parties, former ANC leader and president Jacob Zuma's Umkhonto weSizwe, or MK, poses the greatest danger to the ruling party. The polls indicate MK could take 10% of the national vote, with most of its support coming from people who traditionally back the ANC. In Johannesburg, Leopold Mazibuko is one of many prospective voters who agree with policies put forward by smaller parties. But Mazibuko says come election day, he'll probably vote for one of the famous parties. He says he's going to be confused by all the names and faces on the ballot paper. They're all promising all kinds of things, and it's easy to forget who said what. Mazibuko says he knows broadly what three of the big parties stand for, so he'll end up voting for one of them. It's easier. Politics professor at the University of South Africa, Dirk Kotzer, says with a vast plethora of parties up for election, he doesn't blame voters from being overwhelmed. But he adds, the fact that so many organizations and individuals raised the funds to register for the election shows that democratic politics in the country is a vast landscape, even if victory likely will go to the bigger players. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
From Johannesburg, we go back to Western Equatoria State, where seven religious leaders have written to President Salva Kiir to declare a state of emergency in Western Equatoria State following sustained ethnic violence in Tombora County. With us live from Nairobi is Manasi Zindo, a politician from Western Equatoria State who is familiar with the situation in Tombora. Manasi, welcome on this show.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Talk to us about the situation in Tombora. Why would religious leaders write to President Salva Kiir demanding that a state of emergency should be invoked in Western Equatoria? Do you know why?
I think the letter has been written on the background of the continued insecurity in Tombora, as you noted. Last week, a Catholic priest and his driver were kidnapped, and up to now, their whereabouts is not known. So I think, and the insecurity is increasing. People have run away from the rural areas. I think it is based on that background. That is why the church is calling for the government to take action.
And talk to us about who is causing this insecurity.
You know, Tanga, there's a blame game. Some people are blaming the STLM-IO, which is a component of the transitional government of national unity in South Sudan. Western Equatoria is under them. They appointed the governor. Well, the STLM-IO is blaming people who are in government. So it is really very unclear on who is causing the insecurity. At this stage now, I do not want to call it any longer as tribal clashes. I think the people have literally become criminals.
And yesterday we spoke to a member of parliament representing Tombora in the National Legislative Assembly, Clement Juma Mogonwea. He clearly said that the place where the priest disappeared is called Namtina and is under SPLA-IO. Why would you talk about criminals?
Because the nature of the crisis now is becoming a criminal. Because why would somebody kidnap the priest and take him to a place where he his whereabouts is known up to now? And even when you listen to some of the local people on the ground, I've spoken to some of the church leaders who have been leading PC initiative in Tombora, and the church leaders indicated to me that there are people who are in higher places who are involved in what is going on. So if that is the case, then we can only say these people are criminals.
But we have spoken to several leaders on this show who come from Western Equatoria and specifically from Tombora. It appears like everybody is tiptoeing around who is causing this problem. Why would that be the case?
That is really very unfortunate, because the people who are on the ground and the people who are in Juba representing Tombora at different levels of the government should be able to tell the truth. When you see people dodging the truth like that, Tanza, it means that there are people in higher places who are involved in it, and these are the people whom the government should find out who they are and arrest them and present them before the court of law.
I know that you understand interpolitics in the SPLM-IO because you were once a member. What are the members of SPLM-IO telling you about what is happening in Tombora?
I have not been in touch with them for quite a while now. It is also surprising to me that the SPLM-IO has not issued a statement clearly to distance themselves away from what is happening. Their silence is somehow implicating them. If they are not involved in what is happening in Tombora because Western Equatoria is under their leadership, they should issue a statement clearly telling us their position and what they know of what is happening in Tombora.
Thank you very much, Manasseh Zindo, for updating us on the situation in Tombora County. That was Manasseh Zindo, a South Sudanese politician, speaking to us from Nairobi. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Kenyans capitalize on climate smart practices to enhance their resilience to climate related challenges. That story is coming up right after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The United States Agency for International Development this week launched a $6 million program to support small businesses and financial institutions in northern Kenya that are looking to implement climate smart practices and enhance their resilience to climate related challenges. The region suffers from recurring droughts. When it does rain, it often floods, causing people to lose their livelihood. Muhammad Yusuf reports on the USAID program goals.
Residents of 10 northern Kenyan counties heavily depend on their livestock for food and income. Over the years, alternating periods of drought and floods have killed animals, pastures and crops, leaving millions in need of humanitarian assistance. USAID recently set aside $38 million in loans and investments to build up resilience among small businesses in these arid and semi-arid regions. The $6 million of investment announced last week is part of the larger program. Abubakar Aideruz is the head of SolarGen, an organization that provides sources of power and irrigation tools to farmers in Garissa and Wajir counties. SolarGen received $500,000 from USAID last year. Aideruz says the investment has helped his business reach more places and people.
Because we come from this area and we understand that the services are needed and they are excluded from the, and we understand that the services are needed and they are excluded from the, the financial systems and the grid as well. There is no access to energy, and for us to be able to get this investment, first gave us the opportunity to put up the opportunity and also the courage to move to Wajir and establish an operation there. It gave us the opportunity to turn less customers away.
Veni Mayaka works with a non-governmental organization that implements the USAID KUZA program in northern Kenya. KUZA is a Swahili word for nature. Mayaka says USAID is coming to address the community's most urgent needs in managing the impact of climate change in their homes.
So USAID KUZA is coming in to bridge the gap in terms of providing access to financial services, but also providing incentives in form of financing, catalytic financing. And this financing goes in to address the missing links in terms of provision of water, provision of technical assistance to some of the clients, providing the access to finance, but also providing some of the services to the communities. And this is cascaded down to the community.
Aideru says the financial support his company received enabled it to support its customers and give them more time to repay their loans.
But within 18 months, they're able to take full advantage of the resource that they have, which is the farm, and be able to pay us back and continue with the system. So that really increases their ability to produce. For an SME that wants, say, is operating a hotel and that has fridges and few other equipment that need to be powered, then having constant, reliable, affordable power definitely increases their income.
USAID works to strengthen the capabilities of SMEs or small and medium enterprises. Mayaka says USAID wants to finance people and businesses attempting to overcome climate change issues.
We want to see a scale-up of the number of SMEs reached in terms of climate finance in investments, best practices in environmental conservation, and also innovations towards addressing aspects of climate change. So we'd want to see more micro and small enterprises reached through the financial institutions. And we also wish to see more products developed that are agile to address some of the challenges.
USAID said it is developing a digital tool that allows data entry and captures data points about reducing carbon emissions, energy access, and financial inclusion in its clients' funds. The agency says the tool will ensure that the investments align with its climate change objectives. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move back to the United States, where there is just under 6 months left In the U.S. presidential elections, VOA correspondent Scott Stans looks at what is ahead for Joe Biden and Donald Trump in the run-up to the November 5th.
President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump have 6 months left to persuade American voters to give them a second term. Trump will spend some of that time in state or federal court answering four separate indictments on charges that include unlawful retention of national defense information and falsifying business records. He says prosecutors are interfering in the election.
Everything was legal, and they're doing this because it's for politics. They want to get Biden elected. That's the only reason.
The court appearances are reducing Trump's time campaigning, but he says what he calls a political hoax is only making him more popular with voters.
It's a terrible, terrible thing happening in our country, and hopefully November 5th, the most important day in the history of our country, in my opinion, that's called Election Day, hopefully it's going to change because these people are destroying our country.
The Republican Party last nominated Trump for president at its semi-virtual 2020 convention in North Carolina. This year's Republican convention is in July in the state of Wisconsin. Before then, Trump will need to choose a new running mate. Among those he's believed to be considering for vice president are Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, and New York Representative Elise Stefanik. As the incumbent president, Biden has the advantage of White House events to keep voters' attention. On the campaign trail, Biden is becoming more pointed in his attacks on Trump while claiming credit for a stronger economy.
Construction of new factories has more than doubled in our administration. Meanwhile, Donald Trump still thinks windmills cause cancer. That's what he said. By the way, remember when he was trying to deal with COVID, he said, just inject a little bleach in your veins. He missed it. All went to his hair.
The Democratic Party last nominated Biden for president at its semi-virtual 2020 convention in Wisconsin. This year's Democratic convention is in August in the state of Illinois. Biden is running again with Vice President Kamala Harris, who's been campaigning for restoring federal abortion protections that were ended when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the case Roe v. Wade in 2022.
Donald Trump was the president who took away the protections of Roe. Joe Biden will be the president who puts the protections of Roe back in place.
Before November's Election Day, Biden and Trump are expected to debate. Both men say they're ready. No date's been set. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday, May 7th, 2024. We'll now leave you with the song Mocristo by Papa Wemba. We've been listening to Papa Wemba and the song Mocristo. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Cornelius, we wish you a happy evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.